So those two things, you know, get good at writing and get good at speaking publicly, and then take the opportunity to do those things. You know, when your supervisor says, hey, we need somebody to go talk to the Brokers Association next week, I'll do it. You know, there's not going to be too many other hands up. And it's those little moments in time that get you recognized as being, oh, yeah, Sean spoke to the brokers last week. And then I got a call from the president of the Brokers Association, and they were really appreciative of him speaking. And they thought he did a good job. And then next thing you know, now you're getting asked to speak at different things, or your supervisor's recommending you to speak at different things.
Welcome to CT Strategies Unpacked, a podcast that explores insider perspectives of global trade, customs, and border management. In this leadership series, we talk to current and former trade professionals to get a layer deeper than regulation and enforcement. In this episode, Vice President of Global Services at CT Strategies, Sean Beddoes, recounts the fortuitous journey that opened the doors to a successful career in customs and a life of extraordinary global experiences. Recorded live on January 27th, 2022, this is the fourth podcast in the CTS Meet the Team series.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Meet the Team, CTS's Unpacked podcast series, where we're meeting members of our team here at CT Strategies. Today we have Sean Beddoes, a member of our team. So Sean, we've known each other for a little bit, but I don't want to have to tell your story for you. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thanks, Eric, and I appreciate you having me on the podcast. It's exciting to kind of share my story of how I got here and the trials and tribulations that that occurred on the way. Well, it's a long story. It's funny because I'll probably share this podcast episode with my mother, and her reaction will be what it's been throughout my career, which is, you were such an idiot growing up. How in the world did you become successful? And you know, I can't argue that. That's it's a valid point. That's like the only the love a mother could have, right?
So you know, it's funny because I'm like on the other end of that spectrum. My mother, I was the one that felt I was going to amount to nothing, and my mom's like, "Oh, you're going to go on to do great things. You're going to do great things." And so I look back and I was like, I don't know how I stumbled into the path that I stumbled onto, but it all worked out. So I'll let you continue. Sorry.
Right. Yeah. So the same thing for me, except my mother says, like, "How did that happen?" I'm like, "I don't know. It just happened. Like, I got lucky," but. I was a young man trying to find my way. I had dreams and aspirations of all kinds of things, like many people do. My aspirations and dreams of becoming a professional skateboarder, that died quickly after my third knee surgery at a young age.
How old were you when you gave up on the skateboarding dream?
18.
Wow.
At 18, I had two reconstructive knee surgeries, and then I ended up having a third one after that.
From skateboarding. Wow.
Yep. So yeah, so that dream was cut short. I also had musical aspirations, but you know, that's a tough field to break into. So somewhere in my early 20s, I decided let me pay attention to school and study and see what I can make of myself. And I was interested in at least the curriculum around public administration and criminal justice, and that was what I majored in, and I found it interesting, and I figured, you know, I'll become a cop. You know, it seemed like an interesting, exciting job. So as I was going through school, I was applying for different police, or I was taking different police exams in New Jersey. Also at the time, let me back up a bit. So, you know, I had never traveled outside the country. I had did not have a passport, and I most certainly didn't know anything about customs. I didn't know what customs was. coincidentally, at the time, my father had an acquaintance that worked for U.S. Customs, and they were talking one day about their kids and similar ages and going to college and all that. And when he heard what I was studying and that I spoke a little Spanish, he said, "Why don't you have your son come down and talk to me? Because, you know, there may be some career opportunities in customs for him." So one thing led to another, and I ended up doing an internship there at U.S. Customs in Newark during my last year of college. And that, when I graduated, that kind of turned into a job offer. And the next thing I know, I was headed down to Georgia to the academy, to FLETC, to start to, you know, basic training for U.S. Customs. So that was kind of my—
What year was that?
That was 1996.
Wow, I was in FLETC in 96.
Oh, were you? How about
that? I may have cut in front of you in line at the chow hall or something at one point.
The food was not bad there, I have to say.
No, I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it. I ate well while I was there.
So that's kind of that was my path to customs. I spent 22 years in customs / CBP, as listeners mm-hmm. know, you know, customs, U.S. customs changed when Department of Homeland Security was created after 9/11, and then we became CBP. So, you know, I was a customs inspector and then turned into a CBP officer. And I spent 22 years working for CBP and eventually moved out of CBP and out of the U.S. government. I went to work for the International Air Transport Association in Geneva, Switzerland. And I did that for 3 years before finally coming back stateside to work for CT Strategies.
So you said that you were a college student in Jersey with cop aspirations after your skateboarding dreams were squashed. But you also mentioned that you had never left the country. So how does a kid from Jersey thinking he's going to be a cop end up representing Legacy Customs, basically the U.S. position in Brussels?
Yeah, so I would say that's a 25-year answer, right? So everything I did in my career kind of led up to that moment, or maybe a more correctly, a 17-year answer. I was really fortunate. When I started with Customs, I came back from the academy, and I was immediately assigned to the air cargo team. And the air cargo team, while we did inspect cargo, our primary focus was searching aircraft for contraband. And the team consisted of about half of the team members were seasoned senior customs inspectors that had a lot of experience and been doing this kind of work for years, had, you know, knew the ins and outs and the tricks and, you know, all the things that you only get from doing the job, right? They can't teach you that at the academy. And then the rest of us were all guys right out of the academy. In fact, just as coincidence, it was all guys that I went to the academy with. So there was a group of
all classmates.
Yeah, classmates. There was a group of four of us. And when we came back to Newark, they said, "You guys are all going to this air cargo team." So we went down there and you know, that combination of young, hungry, excited customs inspectors trying to make a name for themselves, trying to find dope, and those seasoned guys really created the perfect storm of success. Mm-hmm. And we ended up leading the country in cocaine seizures off commercial aircraft for 2 years straight. So the first 2 years of my career were a tremendous success. We earned the Commissioner's Unit Citation. We were involved in some training opportunities. We even created a training video that was shared with, you know, throughout customs to other air cargo or aircraft search teams. And that momentum I mean, I believe that momentum really sort of set me on a trajectory of success in my CBP career. So I moved from that team to an outbound currency team, which in Newark we referred to as Buck Stop. It was a plain clothes unit where we would target passengers for undeclared currency leaving the country. Drug money, basically, is what we were looking for. And then I ran the hologram program in Newark, which was, a vetting and clearance, program for, airport employees to access the international area of the customs operation at the airport. And, so that was 10 or 11 years of my career at the airport. And then I moved over to the seaport. And just as luck would have it again, I ended up on the outbound auto team, where we looked for, targeted for, and seized stolen vehicles that were leaving the country. And again, kind of a combination of some older guys that knew what they were doing and younger guys that were hungry and excited. And we had tremendous success. We worked with the NYPD Auto Crime Unit, and we learned so much from those guys. They were like real pros. They were also maniacs too. Like the way they're shown on TV shows is pretty accurate. I would say they're characters. But so we had tremendous success there, and then I went on to do some other outbound activity, running the mobile vacus units and things like that. The opportunity came up to kind of change directions in my career when the CTPAT program came about. And I didn't make the leap immediately, but in 2006, it was 2006, I applied for a position with the CTPAT program, and that's when I left uniform, left the gun, the badge, and put on a suit and picked up a pen and started traveling the world, validating security aspects of supply chains for U.S. importers and other entities that are in the program. So I know this is a long-winded way of getting to
your answer. No, I have a lot of follow-up questions, so don't get comfortable, because I have a few follow-ups. So
All right. So your question was, how did you get to representing the U.S. positions at the WCO? So all of that experience, and particularly the international experience I was gaining while at the CTPAT program, which I eventually went to headquarters and eventually was the acting program director for the national program, all of that provided me with opportunities and exposure to the trade community, executives in the trade community, global conferences and events that I was asked to speak at. And all of that put me in a position where I became very well qualified to put in for the deputy attaché position in Brussels, Belgium. And so that's how I got there. And then once I got there, a huge portion of my portfolio was World Customs Organization related matters. So if I wasn't supporting a U.S. delegation coming out for particular meetings, I actually was the U.S. delegation. I led on a lot of the topics for the meetings related to authorized economic operator, the SAFE framework of standards, data exchange standards, validation best practices, ACAS, a lot of different things. So as an attaché, you quickly become a jack of all trades and a master of none. But fortunately for me, I was able to apply my experience in CTPAT and become a bit of a master in at least one in that whole SAFE framework and AEO aspect of the WCO.
Interesting. So I picked up on a few things that you said while we were talking. That you were caught up in the momentum, that you were fortunate, as luck would have it. And I think this is something that I see when we have these conversations on leadership and careers and just looking back on both. I feel like more often than not, in retrospect, and I think obviously, and we'll get to this in a second, you know, your experience and what you bring to CT Strategies, it makes perfect sense that everything fit together so elegantly on the way to this point or to this juncture in your professional life. But is it safe to say that you didn't have this all mapped out when you were stumbling into U.S. Customs back in 1996?
Oh, it's very safe to say that. It's very safe. I often say, and I truly mean this, I often say, I'm not sure what I want to do when I grow up, right? Mm-hmm. I still feel like I'm trying to figure all that out. So I certainly, I definitely didn't enter U.S. Customs and think to myself, I wonder if one day I can travel around the world because of this job, or I wonder if I can live in another country because of this job. And quite frankly, when I took the job, those opportunities were few and far between. Mm-hmm. It was really 9/11 that changed the position and the organization in such a way that it expanded in this international footprint, and you know, the creation of programs like the Container Security Initiative, where Customs took officers and posted them overseas to do targeting and joint inspections of containers before they came over. The CTPAT program, going around the world and checking security of supply chains, expansion of the presence of attachés for CBP. All of that was just not even part of the conversation when I started the job. So I most certainly never had any aspirations for that international work, because it just wasn't possible, right?
It wasn't on your radar screen.
Yeah, it wasn't on my radar screen, but I've never been really risk averse. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, going to your point of, was this luck, or, you know, right place at the right time? You know, some of that was definitely there, but I also believe that, you know, you've got to be willing to be a little uncomfortable, and you've got to be willing to take some chances. And, you know, let's face it, agreeing to do a job where you're going to be, you know, away from your family and traveling and living in hotels and eating restaurant food for, you know, 120, 150 days a year, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants to do it. You know, the same thing with living in another country. I mean, you uproot your family and you move away from everything you know and everything you're comfortable with. So, you know, I think it was a combination of, you know, opportunities became available to me because of the success that I had, but it was also me willing to take a chance and go for those opportunities. You know, a lot of people wouldn't do that, and that's not a knock against them, you know, but you know, just being able to say, all right, you know what, we're going to go move to another country. And of course, you've got to have your family support for that too. You know, that's another issue. So it's a team effort. It's not, you know, mm-hmm. not just one person that makes that successful, because the whole family has to go through it. And at the end of the day, even though it's scary and it's a challenge, you know, the upside of it is just incredible. You know,
right.
Our daughter speaks fluent French now because of that decision to go live in another country. Our daughter's best friend is from Iceland. I told her, I was like, you may never meet another human being again in your life from Iceland. There's just not that many of them around.
That's right? True. That's true.
Her very best friend in the world is from Iceland. So, you know, those kinds of...
Is she still in Iceland?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, she wasn't. We her family and us, we spent 5 years in Brussels together. Mm-hmm. They relocated to Geneva because they were diplomats. And then 2 months later, I got the job with IATA in Geneva. So our daughters were together for 8 years growing up together. Mm-hmm. They're really like sisters.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, yeah, I think it's a combination of realizing when opportunities are available and then being willing to make yourself a bit uncomfortable to take a chance on those opportunities. I don't even remember if I answered your question, but there you go.
No, that's exactly, it's exactly what I was looking to call out of this conversation is, you know, a lot of folks, especially when they're at the front end of their career, you know, they look at someone who's at, you know, on the back nine of their career or already finished with their career, and they have this enormity of this, you know, challenge in front of them. But I think most people don't realize that it's very, you know, piecemeal, and it's very, you know, methodical in the sense that, you know, it doesn't all happen at once, and yeah. it's a little bit at a time. And just like you said, if you're willing to take a couple of risks, whether it's, you know, leaving your comfort zone geographically or academically, that, you know, you're venturing into an environment where you're just not the subject matter expert, but you're eager to learn it, then I think that opens up so many more opportunities for you going down the road. And then it just so happens that, you know, when you look back on someone's, you know, career, you know, it all, you can see the threads tying it all together, but we're not really readily present at the front end of your career. But just a couple of things that I wanted to ask you just to make sure that we were able to get to the other pieces of the conversation. So you have this illustrious career with CBP, and now you're with CT Strategies. So, I mean, I can tell the value that you can bring just by the things that you just talked about. But talk to us about your time with CT Strategies, some of the things that you've been doing that have kept you busy, and the things that you have that you're building for the horizon for the next year or two.
Yeah, so CT Strategies is, you know, it was kind of an unexpected opportunity. I think like a lot of career government folks, you know, I was counting the days and, you know, I have to do my 30 years and, you know, at mm-hmm. this age, I'll be able to be eligible for retirement and the whole thing. And then, you know, Andrew Fairley, our CEO, you know, we worked together at CBP and we talked for years about, you know, what might be the right opportunity or the right time for me to join the CT Strategies family. And that was a discussion we had, you know, kind of tongue in cheek for years when we saw each other. And then the opportunity, you know, availed itself. We literally agreed on me coming over to CT Strategies the day before the world went into lockdown. So we were having a couple beers in Old Town Geneva, shook hands, and he got on a plane the next day, and the whole world went into lockdown at the pandemic. So then the challenge became like, okay, great. Now how am I going to relocate in the middle of a pandemic across mm-hmm. the Atlantic? And that actually was quite a challenge. Just getting a flight was a challenge, but eventually worked out. So I came on board with CT Strategies as the vice president of global services. So I manage... I basically manage the delivery of all of our projects and our client activity after it comes from our business development office. Then I take it from there with my team. And we're doing all kinds of exciting stuff. You know, obviously a lot of the kind of traditional DC consulting, if you will, but we've started doing some work that I'm really excited about, but it's both international work and both CTPAT work, two different streams. In terms of the CTPAT work, we launched the service line last year called CTPAT Navigator. And, you know, our company is very well positioned to provide support to either companies that are looking to join the CTPAT program or companies that are currently members of the CTPAT program that just need a little help with, you know, meeting all the requirements of the program. You know, right kind of right in the beginning of the pandemic, the CBP launched the new minimum security criteria for the CTPAT program. And so that raised a lot of questions by people. There wasn't the ability to have in-person conferences to sort of educate the membership in a real meaningful way. So having us as an option to kind of fill that void, we've seen some great success there. And it's, for me personally, I still remain very passionate about that subject matter and that program. I really, truly believe in the partnership concept, to improve trade and supply chain security. And, you know, we have other affiliates that have many more years experience than me in the CTPAT program as well. So, you know, collectively we have a lot of experience in CTPAT. So it's really fun watching that new business line grow and just being able to help companies out and provide a true value to them. So that's been exciting. The other thing that we've really been expanding in a lot is our capacity building type efforts around the world, getting more projects around the world, assisting in one way or another customs administrations with a variety of different things. We currently have projects in South America, in Europe, in the Balkans, and we're looking at several potential projects in Asia. So it's exciting seeing, we're still a small company by pretty much any definition, and it's very fun and exciting to be part of that growth. Mm-hmm. And to watch it happen and to be able to infuse some of my crazy ideas into it and see what happens. It's so different from being in CBP, but at the same time, it's not different at all, if that makes right. any sense.
No, to me, it does. To me, it does. Absolutely. So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
We could probably all, wax poetic about, all the things that we've learned and lost in the last 2 years with this pandemic. You mentioned a little bit ago that we at its peak, you were traveling, half the year you were away from home doing these CTPAT validations. So in contrast to how things were done before, where do you see the future of all that?
So it's really interesting, right? I mean, I think we can all agree that the genie's out of the bottle, right? And mm-hmm. Things like you have to go to an office and work 5 days a week. It's just not going to happen anymore, right? I mean, for the most part, we have proven as society that work can get done in an effective and efficient way, in many cases, more efficiently than before, virtually. Of course, that's different for every person. Not everybody's good at working at home. But in terms of the AEO work, it's really created a very interesting dilemma / dynamic. So if we look at the US example specifically, so the CTPAT program, typically in a non-pandemic situation, they'll conduct physical on-site validations of members in around 3,000 a year. So that all stopped, right? Can't travel anywhere. How are you going to do your job? And it took a while to figure it out. And I think in 2020, CTPAT did somewhere around 140 virtual validations. And this was kind of in a pilot sort of concept and trying to figure it out. But then once they figured it out, they plugged it in. And in 2021, they were over 1,800, so about 2,000 between the end of 2020 and all of 2021. And what we noticed in CT Strategies is we were also working on a project in the Middle East for an AEO program. So we started conducting virtual validations in support of that effort. And we quickly developed, identified best practices in the virtual environment. Because if you had asked anybody in supply chain security, particularly AEO programs prior to the pandemic, hey, can, you know, what do you think, instead of traveling over to India to check this factory, maybe we can just do it on a video call. Everybody would say, are you crazy? Impossible.
And I'm not, out of the room.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to say that it's perfect. It is not perfect, but there definitely are some practices and technology that can be leveraged. And, you know, if you do it enough times, you realize, you know, based on risk, not every company is going to fall into the category, but based on risk, I can comfortably validate or revalidate, maybe is the best word, revalidate, because that's what CTPAT has been doing. They haven't been doing initial validation, but revalidate a member. And I can feel pretty confident that I know that they're meeting the requirements and that they're fulfilling their obligations and that they remain deserving of the benefits that they're afforded under an AEO. And you can do all that without physically being there, you know? So I think we're going to see, and it'll be slow depending on the different parts of the world, but I think we're going to see an increase in the option of conducting validations, revalidations in a virtual or a hybrid type scenario. The WCO has already indicated through a newsletter a couple months ago, you know, some best practices for virtual validations. The U.S. has indicated several times publicly that while virtual validations were, you know, the answer to the situation of the pandemic, that moving forward, they're absolutely going to be part of their process. You know, the economy is going to be recovering for years. Budget situations are, you know, in a really bad place. And so, you know, customs administrations are going to have to find, you know, creative ways to do their job with less money. And in this particular context, you know, this is an opportunity to cut down on, you know, on some of those costs, but still fulfill the obligations of the program.
Yeah, so you make an excellent point that obviously the inability to travel or the lack of willingness to travel, you know, wherever you lie on that spectrum, is a huge thing that's kind of been hanging over us for the last 2+ years now. But the impact of that on the economy and many of these customs organizations around the world, you know, are dependent on revenue to exist and to operate. And I remember my last couple of years with CBP, you know, two things we were seeing was one, like, you know, you get an institution like the WCO, I mean, that's, you know, parliament for customs. You know, everybody's been there. You have to go there, and you know, a couple times a year that it's in the big show, and you know, all the heavy hitters come in, and they haven't had a showing like that. And I was looking at the readout from this past year's policy commissions, and everybody was virtual still. And you know, we're two years removed from the start of this pandemic, but more importantly, I think that, you know, many organizations and many customs organizations around the world have found that, you know, it's not a bad thing. Yeah, and it's not necessarily the exact way we did it before, but it doesn't make it a bad thing. Right. So is this work with CTPAT Navigator and AEO virtual validations, is that going to be keeping you busy for the next couple of years, you think?
Yeah, I do. We're seeing, you know, steady growth in that area. I mean, you know, in CTPAT there's over 11,000 members. So, you know, percentage of those members will, you know, continue to be interested in, you know, seeking assistance from consulting firms. I mean, we're not the only company that does that kind of stuff.
But so, we are the only one that has this much CTPAT expertise in house.
Absolutely, yes. There's no doubt about that. Yes, I don't think there's any other company that
we have
has
that market cornered. I think it's safe to say
three former directors of the program.
And possibly another coming, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I think that'll continue to be a steady growth in that business line. And then certainly the international growth, that, you know, we went from, we had some projects in 2021 to, you know, as soon as the year flipped from 2021 to 2022, four more major projects globally. And we're continuing to, to build out bids on other projects around the world. So I really see, our international growth as probably being the biggest opportunity that we have as a company. The CTPAT Navigator, slow and steady. I think that's going to continue, and provide, great value there. But it's really that international work that, to me, is really on the cusp of exploding. I used to call it in CBP the curse of competence, right? Once somebody knows that you do a good job and you deliver on time and those kinds of things, then they keep going back to you. And Eric, from being a manager, those poor employees that you had, that you have that star employee and all you do is punish the poor person because they just get more work than any other employee because you're like, well, I know they're going to do a great job. And, I hope and I think that's the position that CT Strategies is in with all these global projects is, as we continue to do a good job with them, our reputation, just improves and more people hear about us and more opportunities come in. And it's amazing. Some of these projects, they came to us. We didn't go to them. And so, to me, that really demonstrates, we're getting the name out there around the world, and that's exciting.
Right. Absolutely. So I can't help but to notice and to ask, are those comic books on your back wall?
Yeah. It's funny. I have these comic books there. My office was arranged differently. Originally. So I used to be sitting with my back that way. And on that side, I have all these like lovely official things from CBP. And it looks like a professional office. And then this was like the fun side. On that side, there's a bunch of music stuff. But yes, so those are comic books. I grew up collecting comic books. I love that whole escape into the mostly Marvel universe of comics, although I did collect some independent comics and some DC comics. But I don't really buy comics anymore because the movies are so damn good now.
Right.
But I do have a nice collection of comic books that, my daughter's funny. She's old enough now where she asks about it. She goes, how much are those things worth? Who are you giving those to? What's it? I said, well, you can have them because I doubt I'm going to sell them. But.
So I have a brother and two sisters, but we're kind of spread apart in age where it's my brother, my older sister and I, and then there's an 8-year gap. And then it's my younger brother and my younger sister. Yeah. But growing up, my dad was never much of an academic, but he was just addicted to comic books. Even as an adult, as a grown man, as my father, he would still go out, every month and pick up all the new comic books. And he had, a good dozen or so that he followed consistently. And back in those days, the convenience store on the corner is where you would buy them, and they had like a little rack where they'd spend, you go and pick up all the
rack. Spun around, yeah.
Exactly. And so he would go and he'd get off of work and he'd, swing by the convenience store and he'd pick up, this month's, dozen or so new editions, new issues. And then he'd sit there and he'd read them all. And as soon as he finished reading them, he'd hand them to me and then I'd read them all. And then we'd kind of have a quick conversation about, because at the time that was kind of like a soap opera as these stories are evolving and whatnot.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And so we'd have this conversation. And so he kept it up for, I guess, a little over a decade. I don't remember when I was in high school, him still doing it, but he amassed this impressive collection of comic books. And to this day, he still has, I'd say, maybe about a dozen or so file boxes worth of comic books. Mm-hmm. And not too long ago, I was helping him move. And I went into a storage unit and I saw all these comic books. And I was really, for me, it was kind of a relief to see that he still had them, you know, because he's been lugging these things around since he was a teenager. And so I was just happy to see that he still had them. So I made sure I went through them all, and I kind of put them in fresh boxes, and I put them into climate controlled storage. Mm-hmm. And so he was tempted just to toss them. I was like, no, after all these years, you know, my dad's in his 70s now. I was like, you've held them onto him for this long. There's absolutely no way you should get rid of Michael, even if take them off your hands.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, some of them are worth a lot of money. So yeah,
absolutely. If you have some keepers, absolutely. So we could obviously, as you can tell, we could probably go off on a long tangent of comic books.
Yeah, but we'll have to do a separate podcast on comic book collecting.
We should on Marvel Universe. Absolutely. But I heard you say a bunch of different things here that I want to make sure that we close out with. So you talked about obviously not having your career mapped out. You talked about being fortunate and being lucky to stumble into the things that you've done. You talked about how the work that you're doing right now, you're enjoying because you feel like you still have the passion for the work or the type of work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So for our listeners out there that are on the front end of their career and not the back end, What's some advice that you'd give them, you know, now that you've had a chance to kind of at least summarize for the sake of this podcast, what got you here?
Well, I think I don't know. I feel like I'm starting to like feel old now, not just look old, but, you know, I have had the opportunity to speak to some people that are early in their career, not necessarily CBP. And the advice I give them, and I really believe in this, the advice I give them is, there's two things that, in my opinion, really can set people apart from the crowd. And that is public speaking and good writing. And if you can work to get as good as you can at both of those things, that will open up so many doors for you. First of all, nobody likes public speaking. Very few people. I often get told I'm a good public speaker. I still hate it. I absolutely hate it. It terrifies me, but I do it, and I've done it enough now where I find some comfort in it. But if I had to choose to do it, I would never do it again, right? I mean, who wants to put yourself out there like that? But the opportunities that come from public speaking, and the reputation that you get to build, and then nowadays in the environment we live in with technology, you know, it used to be, you know, if you spoke somewhere 15 years ago and you did a good job, you know, maybe a couple of people talked about it. But now you speak somewhere good, and then, you know, it's on YouTube and people are sharing it and everything else. And, you know, so your one little speech can go around the world in a matter of minutes. So to me, that's, I don't know, that's the best advice I can do. If I look back at my career, you know, the success that I had, what the force multiplier in my success was writing well and public speaking well. Absolutely. And it took a while to get good at that. I wasn't great at either one of those things in the beginning of my career.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, Sean, I do appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk to us. And I think that there's so many other things that we could spend some time talking to us, but I do want to let you get back to these important projects that you're working on. So thank you again for joining us on CTS Unpacked. I hope our listeners enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And we look forward to doing another one. Maybe next time we'll talk about either skateboarding, music, or comic books.
Hey, yeah, let's do it. Whatever anybody wants to hear, I'm happy to talk about it. But thank you very much for having me, Eric. It was an absolute pleasure. And yeah, look forward to the next opportunity. You have a nice day.
You too. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this segment of CTS Unpacked. For more information about CT Strategies and our team members, visit our website at ctstrategies.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn to share your thoughts or any ideas you'd like to see in future segments. Stay in the loop by joining our newsletter, where we share the latest CTS updates. Until next time, this is CTS Unpacked.